Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is September 2nd, 2004. Today's session number is DEJ-2004-04. Today's speaker is John DeGraff. The lesson for today is Choosing Time, Promising Alternatives, An Agenda for Change. Let's listen in.
All of that fast pace and busyness and long hours of work on our health and on our family life and our community participation, our civic and political participation, and our environmental stewardship. And we've talked also yesterday, we spent the day kind of talking about what seemed to be some of the reasons why life in the United States has gotten so much seemingly busier and more stressful over the past 30 years, and why so many people seem to be working much longer and having less time for the things that matter. What I want to do tonight is to talk about the major campaign alternative that I've been involved with for the last 2 years or so. And it is a campaign that's broad in the sense that it's not a political campaign, although it does have a public policy component. It's about personal change, cultural change, and political change as well. And it's called the Take Back Your Time campaign, and I passed out a flyer about that to people. And I finished talking about that this evening, and we have a conversation about it. I'd certainly like to invite anybody who wants to be on our national email list to sign your name and give us your email and other information, because we would certainly like to keep you in touch, and we promise that you will not be overloaded. You probably won't receive more than one newsletter a month, and possibly one or two other kinds of things, a press release now and then, or some kind of update to let you know what the campaign is involved with. And we do not give your email address to anyone at all, period. Certainly not without your explicit permission. And so far, we haven't asked anybody for that permission. I also passed out to anybody who would like them some of the books and, as I mentioned, websites and other things that have been useful to me in both the issues that I've talked about, the voluntary simplicity and affluenza, anti-affluenza movement, if you will, and also the time movement. And I want to recommend several of the books on that list that have a very explicitly Christian perspective and message to offer about the issues of both overwork and time poverty, but also you'll see in these books that they also relate to questions of simplicity. And I'll be happy to talk about any of those. And one was one that Emily had mentioned and read from, Sabbath. And I have misplaced my copy of that book, so I'm not positive, Emily, if I'm spelling Wayne Mueller's last name right.
M-U-L-L-E-R.
It is right. Okay. Good. Okay, what I'm going to do to start with is something a little different. I want to kind of inspire in each of you the sense that part of our call, and I think this week's theme, this summer's theme, has been summing out what we can be. It's about our call to use our gifts in ways that make a difference in the world, help others, help the community, and so forth. And so I want to show about 10 minutes of a documentary that I made some 20 years ago. Actually, it was on public television in Minnesota. But it's a story of farm women who were fighting in the early 80s to sort of save family farms, which are, of course, still in crisis and still being lost in a big way. But especially in the early 80s, the farm crisis really hit in a big way, late 70s and the early 80s. And the story that I, the little piece that I want to show you is about a farm woman from Minnesota named Ann Canton, who some of you may know or know about, because she and her husband, Chuck, were very, very active members of the Lutheran Church and involved in it, and also leaders in the farm movement. But I just want to show this little thing because it's kind of the story about how a woman who wasn't really an activist and never saw herself as an activist got a calling to be an activist and to use her gifts to try to organize other people for to make some social change. So
breakfast is ready anytime.
Okay, I'm on the E10 right now. It'll be about 5 minutes.
Okay, this is great.
Ann and Chuck Canton grow wheat, barley, soybeans, and sugar beets in western Minnesota. Three generations of Cantons have plowed this ground.
Good morning. Are you freezing?
Yes, it's cold.
Ann and Chuck know their land intimately and treat it with loving care. They hope their son, Kent, the oldest of their three children, can keep farming here. The Cantons took the advice of experts who said expand for the coming boom in agriculture. They bought more land and bigger machines, but expansion was not the answer. They are hardworking, efficient, productive farmers, but they are going deeper into debt.
After farming on this farm for some over 20 years, Chuck and I looked at one another and realized, you know, there is something wrong. There is something wrong. Is it us? And are we just doing everything wrong in this place? Or what's happening to us in our small town and to some of our neighbors?
Seed, fuel, fertilizer, machinery, credit. The Cantons' costs have tripled in the past 10 years. They spend more than $6 to produce a bushel of wheat, but at harvest must sell it for less than $4. A few giant grain companies dominate the market. The only choice the Cantons have is to sell or wait, hoping for a higher price. But for them, farming is more than a business. It's a way of life. So even though their economic losses mount, they go deeper into debt, mortgaging their land for the cash to keep farming.
Not very long ago, Chuck had to go and borrow money to pay the interest on the borrowed money. And I know he looked at the banker and said, you begin to wonder, are we the only ones that are going through this? And the banker just laughed. And he said, there are many, many, many.
As long as land values rose, farmers survived. But land prices are falling now, and credit is drying up. Every week, more than 100 Minnesota family farms must sell out or face foreclosure. The Cantons know they are living on borrowed time. An auction is not easy for farmers to watch. In the past 30 years, they have said goodbye to more than half of their neighbors. But not since the Great Depression have so many auctions come so often. So many lives been changed forever. So many dreams died so suddenly.
All in all, care one number 53. 53, what more?
just so wrong, I think, for this nation that expects all the abundance and all the good things in the supermarkets and in the stores, and yet that the people who are here and doing it and working the 12, the 14, maybe 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, can't make it. People are going through in Egypt. And he said, Moses, go to Pharaoh. That's where the military and political decisions are made. And what that little story says to me is that we indeed have a responsibility to challenge the pharaohs. If we get 5,000 women, Arnold with a rolling pin, and send them to Washington, D.C.
In 1977, Anne and a small group of farm women heard about a new farm organization, the American Agriculture Movement.
The whole thrust and idea was that we can do something about it ourselves. And it's at the point where we have to do something, that we can no longer rely on the experts. If we want to survive on this land, it's up to the people of the land to do it.
Here, Eddie, I think they need beans here. Right here.
They began to organize meetings, small at first, but larger as farmers heard that others were demanding a fair price and a living wage.
It just got more exciting, and we got to the point where we were organized enough to put together a march on the Capitol in St. Paul. I never protested bodily ever to say that I, as a farmer, was protesting. It was scary for me, but it was also terribly exciting. And the next step then was to say something nationally. We arrived at Washington early in the morning, found our way to Capitol Hill, finally found a place to park, walked for blocks, came around the corner of the Capitol of the United States, and saw 40,000 farmers. I cried. Couldn't believe it. I remember. I remember how good that was for Chuck. Because he grabbed me and he said, "We aren't the only ones."
I've been talking to them congressmen, I thought to know. I've been talking to them senators, way down that road. Said, "I'm tired of all your lies, bribes, and poor guys."
A year later, in January 1979, they were back, this time with their tractors. They demanded federal policies that would guarantee a fair price for farm products and the survival of the family farm.
We found out that we could walk into senators' offices and congressmen's offices, and we could talk to them. We knew what the issues were.
and we can say it straight and strong and hopefully get them to understand. And of course, they didn't understand. But Moses had to go many times. It was the 10th time that Pharaoh finally agreed, and he said, go, take your people. Maybe it's unpredictable. Maybe something will happen. As long as we're still on the land, there's always a chance. And that's what we have to keep fighting for.
Now, I showed that clip not because it's immediately relevant to the issue that we're talking about and have been talking about here, but because I think it's for me, Anne Canton was an inspiration, I think, for many other people, and it's the sense that we have a calling to do something about the things that matter and that are happening to us and to everybody, and it's not, and I think that while I'm sure that Anne would be the first to say that what they did didn't succeed to any degree that they had hoped it might, that it still can be seen to have made some kind of difference and awakened some people. And that struggle is still going on with things like Farm Aid and other things. So many of you may, particularly those of you who come from the Midwest, and I know there's fewer of you now at this point of the season here at Holden, but that was done sort of to inspire people to think that we can all, no matter whether we've never done these kinds of things before, we really all can be activists and help make change. What I want to talk tonight about, though, is the Take Back Your Time national campaign and how it developed and where we're going with it, and I'd love to get some of your input and some of your ideas and comments as well, and hopefully we can recruit some of you to take part in the Take Back Your Time campaign this year and in the future. I was very pleased. I talked about this a little bit. I didn't do a session on this, but 2 years ago when I was last at Holden, I talked about this a little bit, and one family who some of you may know from Decorah, Iowa, the Harts, got very interested and have been very involved in the campaign ever since, particularly Mary Hart and her daughter and their son-in-law. And Mary was just recently at our founding North American Take Back Your Time Conference in Chicago, and she's been very active in her parish and in that community in helping build this campaign. But I think when we talk about a lot of these issues, like affluenza, which I showed the film last night, and running out of time, and the whole idea of our consumer society, and that more is always better, and all the kinds of things that are caught, we understand how I think so many things are connected. John Muir, the great naturalist, once said that if you try to pick out anything by itself, you find that it's hitched to everything else in the universe. There are all these kinds of connections, and that our lifestyle, and this, I think, emphasis on a consumer lifestyle, the good life is the goods life, clearly has impacts on our health, on our families, on our communities, on our civic life, on our children, what happens to them, on our stewardship of the planet, on everything from global warming to you name it. But the big question in some ways is, does it become so big that all of us get just depressed?
Right.
You know, you can see all these connections and all of these kind of things, and it's very easy in the face of all of that to say, God, you know, where do I begin? What do I do? And so some of the question is, if you want to change some of this, then what's the point? Or what are the points that maybe offer the best prospect for a successful intervention in the system? So we talked about that. In the last few years, a group formed called the Simplicity Forum. And Vicki Robin, who wrote the popular book, Your Money or Your Life, a book I certainly recommend to many people, organized a group called the Simplicity Forum. She got together people who had been either writing, making films, doing all kinds of things related to the whole voluntary simplicity movement. And she got a little grant from the Fetzer Foundation, and she gathered those people in one place in a group and tried to think about a strategy for how we could take on and how we could get America a little more interested in simplicity and in lowering consumption patterns, and how we could do that at all levels, from the personal to the cultural. We talked about things like changing the media and the messages that people get through the media. We talked about the personal things that people can do with voluntary simplicity study circles that meet in churches and meet in family groups and community groups. And we also talked about policy and trying to do some kinds of things, understanding that people get very trapped in a system and that they need, in many ways, help that comes from simplicity-friendly policies that make it easier to make the choice that they would like to make about slowing down and simplifying. And so then we talked about, where do we start? If we want to touch on policy, if we want to touch on these kinds of things, where do we begin? And we tried to look for, we had a meeting in Kalamazoo, Michigan in March of 2002. We came together, we had quite a few people, and we were trying to talk about, you know, where is it that Americans feel maybe most immediately, or at least maybe more people feel immediately, the price, the high cost of our current lifestyle. We talked about this for quite some time, and I think there was a general sense that while environment is a really important thing, many people are very concerned about it, and while health is a big thing for many people, that the one thing that seems to be almost universal in our society, at least for people in families and their working years and so forth, is this sense of time stress and time pressure. And that the price that people may be able to begin to understand and think about that they pay for this lifestyle we take for granted is this stressed, pressed, time-pressured life. And so then the question was, so what can we do about that? How do we get that message out, get people talking about that in a way that they can first talk about time and time issues, and then about the whole broad nature of our culture and its priorities that comes from that? And we thought about an event that took place back in 1970 called Earth Day. Some of you may have participated in it. I remember being part of the first Earth Day. It was April 22nd, 1970. And it was a sort of thing where there were teach-ins and all kinds of events everywhere around the country, community events, things on college campuses. And people spoke out about what we were doing to the environment and the damage that we were causing. And they spoke out loud enough. And there were so many of them speaking out that even the politicians, who are often the last to pay attention to these kind of things, began to pay attention. And what we found was that within 3 years of that first Earth Day, We have the passage of all the most significant national environmental legislation in this country's history. We have the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, which created the EPA, the Endangered Species Act, a whole host of other acts like that. All of them signed into law by who?
Ronald Reagan.
Hmm?
Ronald Reagan.
Not Ronald Reagan, 1970.
Richard Nixon.
By Richard Nixon, by a conservative Republican president, Richard Nixon, who might not otherwise have been inclined to do that, but for this groundswell of public sentiment and understanding and concern that we really needed to do something about the environment. So we were immodest and thinking big and thinking, wow, if Earth Day can do something like that, you know, we forgot our humility for a little bit and thought, well, maybe what could a time day do? Or a free time day or something of that sort that would try to put this question that so many people talked about to each other in a personal sense, I'm so busy, I can't deal with it, but which people don't understand to be a social and economic problem. How can we get us to talk about that as a country and understand that in fact it is a social and economic as well as a personal problem? And then, so we decided we wanted to do a day, and then the question was, when should we do the day? And a young Canadian sociologist who wrote a wonderful book called Sharing the Work, Sparing the Planet, which is really about the environmental impacts of our time-pressed culture, and it's also about what the laws are all over the world, that and what other countries are doing, how they've kind of taken this whole thing seriously. Anders Hayden said, well, I think that we should look at the way these folks do the tax, what they call Tax Freedom Day. They say that you pay some day in March, and that up to that date, all your work time goes into taxes. So at that day, they have that, and they talk about lower taxes. So he said, why don't we do a day that says, you know, after if you've worked this long and you were a European, if you'd worked as much as Americans had worked by this particular day, you'd have the rest of a year off. And what he said was, what Anders said was, if you look at the numbers, he's the numbers guy, he said, we work 9 weeks more on average in total hours than the average European does. And so we went back from the end of the year, and we were looking for a Friday, because then we had this idea that we would even encourage people to take the day off. We were thinking big, and I think you have to start by thinking big, and then you come face to face with reality afterwards. But if you don't start thinking big, and you start real small, then maybe you small gets smaller. So if big gets smaller, you still have more of an opportunity. So we came up with the Friday 9 weeks before the end of the year, which was October the 24th. We wanted to do the first one. We knew that it was a little too early to plan such a thing for 2002, so we wanted to do it in 2003. Give us about a little, almost a year and a half to plan this kind of national event, try to get people involved and do community things like occurred in Earth Day. So I picked the date of October 24th, Friday, 9 weeks before the end of the year in 2003. And we didn't know it then. This is just one of these little serendipitous things that happens. We didn't actually find it out until almost a year later, in fact. But it turns out that October 24th is also the anniversary of the date in 1940 that the U.S. got the 40-hour work week. But this was purely an accident that had nothing to do with our choice of that day. It certainly has had to do with our decision to keep that day, instead of doing it the fourth Friday in October or something like that. And the first name we had for the day was Free Time Day, and there was a lot of sense that that'll really seem frivolous because we are really a work-centered culture. And so a professor from the University of Minnesota, Bill Doherty, who was involved with us, who some of you may know, he's probably one of the leading experts on the overscheduling of children in our society today. He's written some wonderful books. Started an organization called Putting Family First, which some of you may know about it, that has mobilized many, many people in the Twin Cities. And he has a book by that name and another book called Take Back Your Kids. And I recommend, the University of Minnesota put out just last year at the Take Back Your Time Day a video with Bill Doherty, which is theirs. There's some things if anybody's interested in it. He was speaking at a Take Back Your Time event to a group of several hundred parents in southeast Minneapolis and talking about these kind of issues of overscheduling of kids. But anyway, Bill said you need to be stronger with the language, and he suggested that we call it Take Back Your Time Day, and that idea stopped people. Everybody else liked the idea that, you know, this is what we should do. And so between the time we came up with that and the day in 2003, we did a whole lot of things. We got people connected around the country, academics, church people, other people, and formed a board of directors to move the campaign along. We created a website, which I recommend that if you're interested in this issue at all, it's just simply timeday.org. And there's some material here. I don't have enough copies of a lot of these things, but there was some material here. It may have been taken, but what you'll see on the website from our campaign, we got some interest from the University of Minnesota at Duluth, and the art department at the university there thought it would be a great project for their students to actually create a whole poster campaign for the Take Back Your Time campaign. And so these were all, it was all undergraduate students. I only have one copy of each of these, but I will pass these around. I had done that before, but you know, you can just kind of flip through them. They'll give you a sense of how broad the issue is and the wonderful work and creativity that students can do. And it's a meaningful thing, especially when it's a meaningful thing for them, because so many times students are doing work and who knows, you know, what it's going to do, what it's going to be used for, or anything. But I came to the university, talked to students about the issue. They started telling all kinds of stories about how they felt that they never saw their parents, even how now many of them were working full-time jobs while they were trying to cope with school. At the same time, they got the art people said, well, even though this was an art class, these students wanted to talk about the issue a lot, and they had a lot of conversations about that. But they came up with all the visual ideas for this whole poster campaign, created all these posters, which are available on our website, and which we encourage people to download, print out, and whatever size one wants, and put them up in places. It's a cheap way, because we can't compete with, we don't have the money to buy big media, to get on TV, you know, with ads and to do these kind of things. But one thing you find is that when people download these things and they put them up in their office or somewhere, anywhere, it stimulates conversation. People begin to talk about this issue. And then, of course, it always has on the website, so they can go there. This has this. Anybody can have a look. And without the web, we wouldn't be able to do any kind of campaign like this, because we had not even the money to mail things out to people or anything. But that has made it possible for all kinds of people to participate in the campaign. Some 30 leaders of the movement came together and all wrote articles, so we put together a handbook. And I was the editor of this, but it's a work of well over 30 people, giving sort of more in-depth explanation of all of these kinds of things and what time pressure does. And then we got out, tried to do as much speaking, other things as we could. tried to reach the media with press releases and so forth, all volunteer, the whole campaign done by volunteers. And the one thing that happened was that the media loved it. I mean, the reporters are really stressed. And, you know, they get it right away, this issue. So by Time Day 2003, by October 24th, we'd had thousands and thousands of visitors to our website. We actually got 33,000 individual people who went to the website on the day alone. Not just hits on the website, but 33,000 people. Somewhere around now, 15,000 people have sort of joined the campaign as members, and many of them have contributed to the campaign. Stories were written about us in about 100 different newspapers, including nearly half of the world, of the U.S.'s 100 largest newspapers, and printed in somewhere between 500 and 1,000 papers. There were magazines that did major features about us. Psychology Today did a feature that had a whole thing with all the students' posters that they had created, and you just can imagine how exciting this was for the students who did this and who actually found that something they were working on as a project for a grade and everything wasn't just about a grade. It was it had a much larger purpose than that. We had about 200 events around the country, ranging from teaching that attracted 1,000 people at the University of Iowa to all kinds of things that were maybe tiny potlucks with just a few people here in town, so forth. But all over we had events, 200 at least separate events, most of them admittedly very small. The irony was not lost on people that we were saying, take back your time, but come to one more to one more meeting, but nonetheless, you can't create a campaign unless people do come and get together and talk. We got the national endorsement of the Unitarian Universalist Church. We got endorsements from many individual churches. We got endorsements from the governor of Michigan and from a number of city councils around the country, many, many organizations. And since that first day, we decided to try to do this each year and to try to get more people involved and get people talking about these issues. And one of the things that I'm really excited about is that the Massachusetts Council of Churches came to us and suggested a partnership. And the partnership is an exciting thing that I would like to see duplicated in other churches and by denominations. And, you know, it's obviously my hope that the Lutherans will come on board on this issue as well. But I'll pass around what the Massachusetts Council of Churches has done. They've sent out to their 1,700 different congregations in the state of Massachusetts a whole, all kinds of things, posters, they've got fact sheets, other kinds of things. If you go to their website, and it's just masscouncilofchurches.org, you'll see that the very front of first page of their website is about Take Back Your Time and about this campaign. And they what they're suggesting is what they call choose four windows of time. And I'll just read a little bit from this pamphlet that the Massachusetts Council of Churches has been spreading out. It says, resist a relentless pace of life for yourself and your children. Take back your time from excessive work hours. Choose four windows of time between Labor Day, September 6, 2004, and Take Back Your Time Day, October 24, 2004, to, and then rest body and mind, reflect on life's deeper meanings, reconnect with family and community, reclaim time, revive energy for life, renew your relationship with Jesus Christ, recreate balance. And then it says, commit to at least four windows of time, ideally a consistent time each week, for 4 weeks, for simple restorative activities, just time to be with self, God, family, community, nature, time to restore your soul. And during this time, you would have no scheduled activities, no buying or selling, no stress, no intrusive technology, No obligations, no work, and no guilt. The last one is probably the hardest, right? So, anyway, I'd encourage holding the tape for windows of time during that period, as well as the community, but I obviously encourage all of you to look at the Mass Council of Churches website and see if there are things that you might be able to bring into your churches on this. The other, yes?
October 24th is a Sunday.
You just read my mind. That's exactly what I was trying to... It is.
Which has usually scheduled church services.
It does.
And, and they're proposing that
we're not,
don't honor that.
No, we're not proposing that at all. We absolutely think that that should be honored, and that this would be... what we're hoping is that in churches around the country, maybe this year people talk about the importance of the Sabbath, about having time for life, and we know that that's going to happen. We're even, you know, going to have on our website, we're starting to collect some sermons about this issue that people who will be preaching that day can maybe use information and other things from, because we know that a number of churches, that some pastors will actually talk about it from the pulpit that day. We also know that some churches after the service will just have some kind of thing where maybe a potluck or other things where families come together and talk about time and talk about the Sabbath and talk about where all these things have gone. So we're not suggesting that people don't go to church that day. That's a whole different thing. We're suggesting that they ask, why have we lost the Sabbath? And why has everything become now 24/7 so that, you know, that a lot more people are spending their time at the mall. Far more people go to the mall on Sunday than go to churches. So and this year I think that, how many churches will do that? We don't know. The Unitarians, as one group, are certainly encouraging it to be done, and we hope a number of others will do so as well. So that's one thing. And the other aspect of our campaign, which is partly getting people to talk about this, try to, you know, change their, if their families have too frantic schedules, figure out what can I reduce from that, how can I change things in my personal life. But then we also have a four-point legislative program that our goal has been, and we're not very successful. We're not getting anywhere near where we want to be, but we have to understand, as Anne said, Moses had to go many times. And we have to have patience, and we have to accept that this is going to take a while. But our four-point legislative program is the following four points. The first one is to make Election Day a holiday. And this may seem superficial, but it's really about the idea that we need time for civic and political life and participation in this country. A number of states have already begun to do that, which is, I think, a good start in the right direction. The second one is the family values one, and that's to have a paid family leave for childbirth. The state of California has adopted a six-week paid leave program. Other states are talking about doing that. We're not specifying this is what your program should be, but we think that we should be talking about that in our political campaigns, about some kind of paid leave. The other thing is a paid minimum 3 weeks paid vacation for all American workers, because now 26% of working Americans get no paid vacation at all. And we are the only industrial society in the world where that is the case, that we don't have any kind of guaranteed paid vacation. And the fourth point is to put a cap on mandatory overtime, overtime that's required where people don't really have any choice about it at all. And there are an awful lot of Americans who are working overtime that they don't want to work, that they
rather spend that time with their families. And so we're saying that after 48 hours on the job a week, people should have a choice whether they want to put in more overtime or whether they want to be home with their families. Each one of these 4 points, and they're the beginning of the things that we're thinking about, are already the law in every other industrial country, and even to a greater degree. You know, longer vacations than we're talking about, more paid leave. The European Union, the Canadian provinces all have laws about either 44 or 48 hours as a maximum work week. You know, but we in the U.S. have no rule. We have one. California has a rule. You can't make anyone work in California more than 72 hours without their having something to say about it. And Maine has another one that's even more interesting. The law in Maine is that you can't require people to put in more than 80 hours of overtime every 2 weeks. I'm serious. And this is the best we get. I mean, this came about because in 1999, after a terrible winter storm, ice storm in the Northeast, a fellow named Brent Churchill, who was a lineman working on restoring the power in Maine, had been on the job 96 hours in the course of a week. He was so exhausted from this that he forgot to put on his protective gloves when he touched a high voltage power line and he was electrocuted. And that stirred up a whole thing about why should people really be working that long. And so Maine passed a law, but the law is, you know, 80 hours of overtime is the maximum every 2 weeks. In other words, you could work people 80 hours a week before they have any choice. So we think that's a bit extreme. So that's kind of where this campaign is. We're starting to get support from a lot of places. One of the funny things is that we get a lot of interest from corporations in this campaign. They always, though, are, for the most part, call us to say, we'd like to sponsor your campaign if you will endorse this or that time-saving device. And so most recently, the Dish TV people, they have one of those things. They have a new product that, you know, gets rid of the commercials. So you can watch a show, a regular half-hour show in 22 minutes and stuff. I mean, I'd probably like one of those. I have nothing against that particular product, but they've said, you know, Time Day endorses that product, we'll give you the money, but we felt that that was hard for us to do. Now, the one exception has been the Hilton Hotel Corporation, which has been very supportive of our campaign. Obviously, it's in their self-interest that if people have some vacation but regardless of that, it's in a lot of people's self-interest. It's in the entire tourist and recreation industry self-interest, and Hilton is the only one that has actually recognized it and done something. And they've done a lot. They've done a number of studies. They've been actually supportive of our legislative campaign, which really surprised us. And I have a few of these that this particular was a series of studies that Hilton did. They did studies of how much people work, and they published these and brought a lot of them to our founding Take Back Your Time conference in Chicago this past June. We had people from all over the U.S. and Canada, and some from Europe, who attended. And it's what Hilton did was in this is really quite remarkable. And they're doing actually a lot of stuff, but just looking at how much we work, what the impacts are on health, and all of the kinds of things that we talk about, how much stress. These kind of things. So there's only a few of these, but I will leave them here. If you're really interested in our campaign and in these issues, I encourage you to take one of the Hilton things. And Hilton is continuing to be very supportive. Yes?
Do you think your third point was talking about paid 3-week vacation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember how you worded it, but I was assuming that you were talking about full-time workers. But in the USA, the issue is so many people are now part-time.
Mm-hmm.
Or
so how are you projecting for them?
Well, I think we would have to look at this in terms of some kind of prorating, just like one would do with benefits. For example, let's take a country like the Netherlands, which probably, and I could pick almost any European country, but the Netherlands probably has the most comprehensive set of policies to protect people's time and to encourage, in fact, part-time work. So in Holland, the government policy is that if you are parents with young children, you shouldn't work more than 60 hours a week between the two parents. It's called the 1.5 jobs policy. And it's not coercive. They don't say you can't do this, but they do all kinds of things to encourage that. So they say, by law, you have the right to ask for part-time, to lower your hours to part-time. And the employer needs to let you do that and give you the same hourly rate. Obviously, your overall salary will drop. And then your benefits. So supposing you're working 5 days a week, full-time, and then you decide to go to 3 days a week, which you then have the right to do as a Dutch worker. You will go to, of course, 3 days pay instead of five, and you will keep your full vacation allotment in terms of weeks, and the average Dutch person's vacation is roughly 5 or 6 weeks. 5 weeks is pretty much the law for paid vacation in the Netherlands. But, you know, when you're a full-time worker, that means 5 weeks of 5 days that you get paid. You're paid for 5 days. Now, when you go down to part-time, for the 5 weeks that you're off on vacation, you're only paid for three days for each of those weeks. So these things are prorated. Benefits are prorated, other than health care, which is simply guaranteed because everybody gets it. And it doesn't matter whether you're working at all. That's something that you get by law. So those kind of that's what we'd have to do here. We need to work these things out, but we feel like we can. I mean, that every other country seems to be able to find a way to do these things. And clearly, it's more difficult for small businesses and things of that sort. So there are these countries have various protections. They don't say that if you work for a small business, you don't have a right to vacation. But they help with tax breaks and other things to the small businesses, or the government itself actually may pay part of their vacation time. So, mm-hmm.
What's been a response from the medical community since we're talking about issues of physical and mental and spiritual health, of course?
Well, what the response we've had has been very, very positive. I mean, we've had quite a number of doctors who have gotten involved in the campaign. We hear from doctors all the time. They just see this problem with people. And one of them, Paul Ballinger, who's frequently here at home, and whose wife Susan teaches the same sort of stuff that Joe Arnett is teaching this time. Paul works in a clinic in Wenatchee, Washington. Paul says that, 80-90% of the complaints of patients that he sees, really physical complaints, really have a direct connection to the stress of overwork and over busy lives. And we hear that from many, many doctors, but a lot of them then also say that many of these patients will say to them, but gee whiz, I'm doing this for my health care, my health benefits and stuff. It's this catch-22, I had a doctor from San Diego that she tells patients, you're going to kill you, you're working too much, you're going to kill yourself, you're going to have a heart attack, you're going to have all these kind of things. I mean, you're shortening your lifespan, you really should cut back. And the person will say, well, doc, you know, but if I cut that, then I won't have this job, and then I won't have health to care, and then I won't be able to see you. So it's catch-22.
John?
Yeah?
I'm hearing from people who are providing health care that they are as much caught up in this overscheduled, busy lifestyle as the rest of us.
Absolutely true. And I was asked to actually write an article, which I did for a publication for doctors around the country about this, because doctors are really feeling this, and they feel that, you know, there's this pressure to see people faster and faster that's part of managed care. So that the average doctor time of patient and doctor visit today in America is 7 minutes. The official time allotted is 15 minutes, but half of that is spent in paperwork that the doctor needs to do and so forth. So the actual time is about 7 minutes, and doctors tell me, you know, a lot of these kind of things, they're really somewhat complicated lifestyle issues involving this. What I really would like to do is have enough time to talk to these people about changing their lives. But, you know, I give them a pill instead because there isn't time to talk about those kind of things. Absolutely. The medical profession is feeling it really big time. Yeah.
A lot of emphasis, I know, is on legislation, and that's fabulous and important. I want to ask you about a different angle, and that is, I was impressed in the Running Out of Time video about the history of the Kellogg Company, and how, aside from legislation, how businesses might on their own be inspired to think about reasons to alter their practice. And I am very encouraged myself, and there's a term that maybe you know, but in business schools today and at Seattle University, the business curriculum is built around this, what's called the triple bottom line. Mm-hmm. In a business plan, rather than being based on the bottom line, which is the dollar, the triple bottom line is people, planet, and profit. And how do you improve the lives of people while caring for the planet and growing a profit as a company? And so a move toward sustainable models of business, which is really growing in this country. I mean, it's a very radical, kind of progressive idea that's growing in, you know, in the business schools. And I think that's really exciting and interesting as well when folks, I mean, if you're in a capitalist country and you're going to work with a system, I think sometimes with legislation you can fight for years and years and years to get great legislation, and then somebody finds a loophole and a way around it and they exploit somebody else with the wrong rules or... But for businesses to be inspired to create effective business models and improve the lives of people, I think it's a really fabulous thing. Can you comment on...
Sure. And we're actually getting a lot of interest from business schools and things. And there certainly are... In Indiana, for instance, a guy named Ron Healy started what he called the 30-40 Now campaign. And he found that in Indianapolis, there were a number of businesses that actually could get better workers that they needed to stay on and things by actually offering 40 hours pay for a 30-hour work week. And it's worked to some degree there. But what we hear also from businesses is that it still helps to try to level the playing field through some kinds of legislation, because the way a lot of these things work now is that the good folks get penalized for doing the right thing, especially because in this country, unlike other countries, the benefits part is such a big deal. And that's why Kellogg's had to change.
Exactly.
When you're paying the health care and stuff, I'll get to this in just 1 second, but you know, it's different. The legislation, there may be loopholes, and there's always some loopholes, but it makes a difference. And I'll tell you just a little story of a conversation I had with a Dutch professor in April when I was in Amsterdam. And this is the University of Amsterdam has an entire department that basically studies work-life balance around the world and the different differences in things. And so he was telling this story. He said he had just, a short time ago, had interviewed the head of Hewlett-Packard in the Netherlands, who was an American who had been sent over a couple of years ago to manage the Hewlett-Packard division in the Netherlands. And he said, he said to the guy, well, you know, have you noticed the difference between the work rules and other kinds of things here compared to in the United States, and what's that difference meant to you? And he said, the guy kind of laughed and said, well, I'll tell you, I kind of noticed that 2 years ago in my first week on the job. He said, I showed up, I'm head of the company here, and he says, and it's Friday, and I call up my secretary at home, And I say, I really need you to call so-and-so and so-and-so and email so-and-so and so, because we've got to have this done, because we've got to have all this stuff by Monday morning in order to do something, get some particular kind of thing out. And so he told the Dutch professor, the Hewlett-Packard guy, says, my secretary says to me, well, excuse me, but I don't normally work on the weekends after 5 o'clock on Friday, and I certainly don't expect to be called at home during my weekends and asked to do these kind of things. And he says, well, excuse me, but I'm the new manager here, and we operate in a global economy, very competitive, and we have to have things that have to be done in order to compete, and we really like it when we have employees who are team players. And I really like to see you be a team player. So she said, well, yes, sir. She said, all right, I'll do as you ask. She says, but I need to remind you of a couple of things. And he said, okay, what's that? She said, well, number one, it's the law in this country that if I have to do any kind of unscheduled work between 5 p.m. on Friday and 7 a.m. on Monday, you have to pay me double time. 200%, that's the law. She says, now, she says, I could use the money, be all right, this isn't so bad, I'll do this. She says, but I'm a team player. I'd like to help the company out. I don't want to waste your money. If I do this, I can call so-and-so and email so-and-so, but they're not going to respond because they're not used to this, and it is not part of the thing, and they're not going to be checking their email, and they're not going to appreciate getting a call from me asking them to do something during their weekends, which are sacrosanct for them. And she said, so, you know, what I'd really suggest you do, sir, is kind of cool your jets and come on in Monday morning and we'll work hard, we'll get this stuff out, it'll be okay. And the guy said, so he said he was completely frustrated. He hung up the phone, said, forget it, and hung up the phone in frustration and stewed all weekend. But indeed, you know, on Monday, work got done, people were very, very productive, life went on, the company didn't collapse, and in fact, we were able to do. And so the guy said he got used to it, and now 2 years later, he says he sees that it's a much better, although it's required, it's a much better way to work. And to top it off, the way he finished to the Dutch professor was, he says, and now even I have a life. So this is how we need both. I mean, we need to encourage those things, but sometimes legislation transfers. Yes. Mm-hmm.
The original legislation, like in Europe, let's say, like Germany lost World War II, and Italy and Japan, they had more time than us, and so the original legislation, was it a reflection of more self-enlightened about the issue, or because they wanted to attack employment issues at the end of World War II and scarcity issues? That's the roots of the legislation.
Well, it took a while. You know, the U.S. still had hours about the same as those in Western Europe until the mid-1970s. The Netherlands, for example, now the world's shortest work hours, still had Saturday work until 1968. And Sweden didn't get the 40-hour work week until 1973. This has been a more recent kind of a phenomenon. And but in Germany, it's an interesting thing, because a lot of people I talk to in Europe say, well, the German workers actually won World War II. I said, well, how's that? Well, because you know what happened after World War II? The Allies just wanted to punish German corporations for having supported Hitler. So they required that, as part of the German Constitution, that the Germans had to do what's called co-determination. Anybody know what that term means? Mm-hmm. By German law, any company with over 50 employees has to have half of its, 500 employees, has to have half of its board of directors elected by the workers. This is law. So it means that there's a whole lot more participation in the public. The Allies would never have imposed that on their own companies. They imposed it on the Germans. And it resulted in the German workers having all kinds of power and say. So in England, they joke about this and they say, oh, those Germans, they may have lost militarily, but they won. Because we gave them all the breaks, you know, in order to punish their industry. But these are some of the things that are different. And then one of the things that our companies will consistently say is that we can't do this. You know, we can't do it and be competitive. We can't, if you do any of this kind of legislation, we'll just ship all the jobs to China and India and all these low-wage countries and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that if you look at, and this is something we never talk about in this country, we're always talking about outsourcing of jobs. But when you actually look at the numbers, where has the bulk of U.S. overseas investing gone in the last 20 years? By far, it's gone to the countries that are part of the European Union. So that even today, American business invests 10 times as much in Holland with 15 million people as it does in China, about 10 times as much as it does in India, and even 3 times as much as we do in Mexico. But that story never comes out. We not only do that, but we make money. The companies find that it works. They earn money in those countries. Their rate of profit isn't always quite as high as it might be in China, but their risk is a whole lot less. And their overall situation works very well. So they find the very same companies that say they can't do any of this stuff here find that they're able to deal with 5 weeks vacations in their Dutch plants and their Swedish plants and their German plants and so forth. So it's kind of a myth. And to some degree, while I do understand the concern about globalization and about outsourcing to low-wage countries like China, to some degree, when we focus all of our attention on that, we play into the hands of companies who actually like to create that sense of fear, that there's really no alternative. You know, and that we if we do anything, then they'll just ship to China. It's not that easy. It's not that easy just to ship everything to another country. And the stats don't back that up, but we don't think about that as much. Anyway, long answer. But I think we need legislation and we need these good companies that see that it's also going to be good for their bottom line to have a workforce that isn't exhausted.
What kind of response are you getting from organized labor, if any?
Oh, from organized labor. An interesting thing. It's generally positive. In the Take Back Your Time handbook, we have one of the essays is written by several people, key people in the AFL-CIO, including the top female director, Karen Nussbaum, who's the assistant to John Sweeney, and was in the Running Out of Time movie. She used to be the head of the women's division at the U.S. Department of Labor under Clinton, but she's clearly no more in that position, but she's... I called Karen because I'd interviewed her and I met her making Running Out of Time. So after we started this campaign, I called Karen because she now works right in John Sweeney's office at the AFL-CIO. Told her about the campaign and said I was coming out to Washington, D.C. and I would like to meet with her. And she said, sure, you know, let's have an appointment. Come on up. And so if anybody's ever seen the AFL-CIO, I mean, it's a huge place. It's a square block in D.C. And Karen was up on the 8th floor, so I got up there, and she was way, and I told her about the website and sent her some of the materials. She had the materials in hand, and she said, let's talk about this. And I said, okay. She said, well, you know, the AFL-CIO hasn't paid very much attention since prior to World War II to these kind of issues. And I said, yeah. And she said, but some of us, and I think that includes the president, think we should. I said, well, that's really good. And she said, so what I think is that if we can work on this together, that you may be able to help the AFL-CIO change its thinking as much as we can help you in your campaign. And I had already developed an outline for a book, the book that I wanted to do, and had a number of people on it, and shown that to Karen, and Karen said, well, the book seems great, but it's got a serious flaw. I said, well, what's that? She said, well, you have things in here about organized labor, but nothing is by organized labor. And I said, well, that's true. I haven't had the context, and I haven't been able to find somebody. And she said, well, I suggest you change that. And I said, okay, yeah. You know, how should I do it? She said, well, I would suggest that organized labor, that the labor movement write a chapter for your book. And so I just kind of said, well, would they do that? And she said, we'd be delighted. You know, so I think that they're trying to talk about this more. I think it's a tough one. You hear from the unions that two things. One, that they have, one of their problems is that the most vocal members of the unions are higher paid single men who are the ones who like having overtime the most. And they, anything that they see as sort of a threat to these hours and to the wage side of it bothers them. And often the people, it's an interesting thing in labor, but we're often, you would think that, for instance, it would be when issues in the contract come up of time versus money, that it would be the poorer paid workers who'd be wanting the money and the people who are making a lot of money who would want the time. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
Every labor person I've talked to says it's quite the contrary. The poorer workers are often the ones who want time. Because they have often family responsibilities, they can't hire somebody to do this or that for them. And it's the higher paid workers who, with time and a half and things, get even more money, who consistently choose the money and who have a lot of influence in the unions. But there is interest, and it's starting to change. The first union body that endorsed our campaign unanimously was the Central Labor Body of Duluth, Minnesota. We have a lot of support in Duluth, Minnesota for this. Anyway, I've gone on for a long time, and I'm sure some of you would like to do some other things, but I'd be happy to talk further with anybody about these issues. I'm sorry that I'm going to be leaving tomorrow, and I really appreciate what a wonderful group everybody has been during this time. How you kind of put up with my sermonizing and all of this sort of thing. But I'd certainly invite and please encourage any of you who want to be on our email list to sign up here. Let us know if you have any interest in taking this back to your church, to your community, to your workplace, wherever. And of course, you don't need to do that. You can always just go to the website at timeday.org and sign up for the email list. But if you sign up here, we'll do it for you. So, any other questions before people want to rush up?
Well, I just want to say that I've certainly experienced this as a real epidemic where I work. If I ask anybody in my office, what's the number one source of dissatisfaction, it has to do with time, that time crunch. And what somebody said about part-time, the question about part-time, several places I've worked, I see that as a real key to somehow easing the situation.
Make part-time more desirable and have.
Well, it's very desirable. A lot of people would love to have part-time. They could live on that amount of money, but it's the whole benefit thing. They could prorate, and the company too is in a bind, because if they can keep people, a small number of full-time people working 60-hour weeks, you know, because of the benefits, you know, they can.
Most of the European countries have some form of medical and child care.
Yeah,
and all sorts of
they have to pay benefits to part-timers at any level. If they work 20 hours, they pay 50% of a 40-hour benefits. I think they do a lot of work part-time because it's a real benefit to the corporation. If you get a person working for 30 hours, you're in good shape for 30 hours. And the way we work, we'd end up working 40 hours anyway. A lot of it. But still, that's working 40 instead of working 50.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to try to include that whole question of part-time parity, as these laws are called in Europe.
Academia and community colleges especially. The bulk, when I taught community college, the bulk of the teaching was done by part-timers.
The adjunct faculty.
And the schools had to do it because they didn't have to pay benefits. And so they keep them right at that level, and not just that academia, but other jobs too. They keep them right at that level where they don't have to pay benefits. And, it's really a terrible bind when many people got in.
I think we can really think about doing those kind of things. And if we took seriously the whole idea of, I really believe, of family values, we say time is a family value, and then if we took that seriously, that families need that, then we'd be doing some of the things that these other countries are doing for families. Mm-hmm.
This is kind of a personal question. In your own personal life, how have you taken back your time?
Okay, John.
No!
Where's the truth? Where's your wife?
The moment of truth. Yeah, where is my wife? Taking a break. Now, I think two things. I get this a lot. I mean, I do a lot of radio interviews and newspaper interviews and things like that about this campaign, because there really is interest out there. And invariably, it always comes down to that. There's always that question, so how many hours a week do you work? I mean, they always kind of put it like that. And I have a quick response. I say, well, a whole lot less than 40 for pay. That sometimes ends the conversation. But then they say, some people will say, well, what do you mean by that? And what I have to say is that I'm a little less good about that lately, because the Take Back Your Time campaign, my volunteer work has sort of become my main work, and I'm spending more time on it, and so I'm a sort of a temporary case study in everything I criticize. Take All My Time Day. I try hard, and I think if you talk to my wife about this, I think what she would say is that I'm always home for dinner, and I still have found some time to coach Little League baseball and do things like that, and I don't work very much on the weekends, a little bit, but not very much. I mean, I don't work horrendously long hours, and I think she would say that I'm pretty good about this stuff, except when I travel, which is, I'm probably spending 20% of the year traveling, and that's not about the Take Back Your Time campaign, that's my work as a television